Welcome back to MEC Connect. This is Matthew Yaling, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Patty Reinecke. In today's episode, we have Jeff Pack with us, and we're going to discuss failback syndrome.
Welcome, Jeff. We're glad to have you along today. A lot of the cases that we see here at Midwest are pretty complicated when it comes to the medical. And so we're happy to have you share some of the information that you see and some of the experiences you have with the claims that we see here at Midwest. I know in my experience here, the first couple times I've got a couple of claims come across my desk, I was like, what did I do? This is not the typical work comp claim we see here or we see in the work comp world, but I guess we all love a challenge.
All right. So in the first few episodes, we've had Cam, Sherry and Dan introduced what a migratory claim was, and Dana joined us and tell us about sprains and strains and how they turn into excess claims. So the question that I'd like you to kick us off with, Jeff, is do you really see claims that originated as a sprain or a strain in the excess world?
Well, before I answer that question, thank you for having me, Matt, and I'm happy to be here. Many of the back injury claims begin as a sprain or a strain at first report of injury. Unfortunately, by the time they come to the excess layer, many of the claims that I see are after a back surgery has already occurred. Potentially, sometimes multiple back surgeries have occurred before they reach Midwest. When an injured employee continues to have pain and other symptoms after a back surgery, they end up with a diagnosis of failed back syndrome. Failed back syndrome is a term that is used to describe an unsuccessful back surgery. This can be any type of back surgery, from the removal of a herniated disc to a more complicated procedure such as a spinal fusion. We see many back injuries at Midwest. For example, I was involved in a claim where a nurse was pushing a motorized bed and the battery failed, and that caused her to have low back pain. She was diagnosed with a low back strain, and after she underwent physical therapy, medications to treat her pain, it still didn't cure the pain. Her MRI did not show any surgical lesions. The doctor even tried injections to try and shrink potential swelling that could cause pain, but that was unsuccessful as well. After 14 months of conservative treatment, surgery was recommended and approved. Unfortunately, she ended up with a postoperative infection and needed a second surgery to treat the infection. When Midwest received the claim, the diagnosis of failback syndrome had been given. There was also another claim where a mechanic injured his low back while working on a vehicle. Conservative care was tried again and failed, and eventually surgery was performed, but that didn't resolve his symptoms. In the mechanic's case, the surgery was a fusion, which is where two bones in the back are fused together, and that is done to prevent instability of the spine. Unfortunately, after the first surgery, a second surgery was recommended above the original fusion. This is known as an extension of the fusion. This was followed by a third extension of the fusion. So you can see with a chain of events like that, when what starts out as a simple strain ends up in the excess world.
Thank you for those examples. Yeah, the whole term failed back syndrome is really nothing anyone ever wants to see on themselves or any claim coming across their desk. So what we're trying to figure out here is how to prevent those things, any kind of failure. But of course, a diagnosis with failed back syndrome is particularly haunting. So are there any common trends you see on the claims that you deal with in the excess world, different kind of back injury diagnosis that you see frequently on claims? And if so, any other kind of interventions or any potential to direct those claims in a different way to deal with those claims and kind of hope that you prevent that failed back syndrome diagnosis?
Failed back syndrome is something we see quite often, Patty, but we do see other diagnoses as well. You have to look at the root cause, and back injuries occur for many different reasons. Back injuries can occur when someone is lifting something, which most people think of. But think of the examples that I gave. That first one, someone pushing an object and it stops suddenly. You can also be bending or reaching in an awkward position or even twisting, and that can cause low back pain. While all injuries cannot be prevented, anything you can do to prevent an injury is key. When I was working on the floor of the hospital, there was always equipment that would help us lift, move, and transfer patients. In addition to just the online training, we also had hands-on training with the equipment, so we were able to use the equipment to move a patient, keeping our patients and ourselves safe and free of injury.
Great. Thanks for that example. I think when we think of failed back syndrome, or if we see that in the medical record or medical report, or a doctor or a medical management consultant is saying that is related to a claim, are there some tips or some advice that you would tell someone, you know, if you see this diagnosis in one of your injured employees' files, or if you hear the nurse case manager talking about failed back syndrome, what should someone do?
One of the first things you need to do is be proactive. Don't just set it on the back burner and don't just let it sit. That can be detrimental to the injured employee. If you address a problem quickly, what is a small problem now, left unaddressed, can be a larger problem and more complicated problem down the road. One of the best things to do is find a physician, a good physician, that has your goals in mind and the goals of returning that injured employee back to work. One of the type of physicians that we see are a physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor, or PM&R for short. These doctors usually align with good physical therapists, many of whom specialize in treating backs. These physicians will talk to the injured employees to make sure that when they return to work, it's successful. That might be a recommendation of limited duty, or if there is another temporary assignment that can be given to this employee to return them to the workforce and still allow them to continue that healing process. It re-engages them into the work environment and gets them back into that thought process of, I'm back at work. If you do run into complications, and many of the claims that we see at Midwest do, you may want to consider assigning a nurse case manager. Assigning a nurse case manager gives you direct access to the treating physician, the therapist. In addition, they can also help coordinate care. Nurse case managers can also alert you if there are certain aspects of the claim that need additional attention. And as I said before, if you catch something early with that small problem, it doesn't progress into a much larger, more complicated problem down the road. Additionally, an injured employee can also have certain comorbidities that increases the likelihood of ongoing treatment. Injured workers with diabetes or that are smokers will have reduced blood flow to the injured tissue, which will delay their healing. If a person has been out of work for a while, they may be deconditioned, or they may become obese or be obese, and that will also extend the time off from work as core muscles weaken from an activity, and extra weight puts additional stress on their bodies. In addition to the PM&R doctors, we also see neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons. Sometimes surgery is recommended for the injured employee, and even with the best efforts to prevent complications, injured workers end up with a diagnosis of failed back. No one, not even the best doctor in the world, can see into the future and determine the outcome for their patient. But there are steps you can take to minimize the risk. If surgery is recommended, consider a records review or getting a second opinion from a physician who is conservative in their treatment. In certain cases, a record review may be helpful before that surgical options or an independent medical review is recommended. When a physician gives a second opinion, they not only review the treatment up to date, but they also complete a physical exam of that injured worker to ensure that the clinical findings correlate with the objective testing. It's an extra set of eyes instead of just having one person's opinion. They may agree with the original physician's recommendation, or they may recommend additional conservative treatment, possibly such as some type of physical therapy, maybe a brace, or another exercise program such as Pilates or yoga, prior to recommending an additional surgery. We also see pain management doctors. In addition to various back surgeries, many of the claims we see include the recommendations for spinal cord stimulators. These are presented to the injured worker as the golden ticket to pain relief. Now, if you think of commercials for prescription medications that you see on TV, they talk about the wonders of the drug, and at the very end of the commercial, they talk about the risks and complications. And they do that very, very quickly, I might add. The same can be true for the spinal cord stimulators. The wonders of the devices are touted, but when they come to the risks and complications, those are kind of brushed to the side or covered very, very quickly with not the same emphasis as the benefits. When spinal cord stimulators are implanted, and this is either done with a trial or a permanent implantation, there's many risks. They have the risk of infection, and that infection can cause permanent spinal cord injury or paralysis. Bleeding can occur, which can lead to a hematoma, which can cause permanent spinal cord injury or paralysis. The spinal cord is a very, very delicate part of our body. You can have cerebral spinal fluid leakage. In addition to that, you can also have allergic reactions to the materials that are implanted into the body, or you can have a battery failure of the unit, or the battery can leak. All of those last three items require an additional surgery to correct. Additionally, because it's a piece of equipment, it needs maintenance. So that device has to be changed about every 7 to 9 years, and that can drop down to about every 5 to 7 years as well. There was one claim, one of the injured workers had a spinal cord stimulator placed. Very quickly after that, she developed an allergic reaction and had to have that spinal cord stimulator and the leads removed. Not only did she have the risk of the additional surgery, but she had additional complications because of the allergic reaction that she has still had to deal with on a longer-term basis. So just like with surgery, if a spinal cord stimulator is recommended, consider a records review or a second opinion from a physician with a more conservative approach in their treatments.
Thank you. That is great information. And I think you also hit on two trends that we're seeing. You know, Dan Dalton did our session of the podcast, and he also talked about the chronic pain side of the cases that we see here at Midwest. And chronic pain is a huge problem. When people are in pain and in pain for an extended period of time, I think they are open to a lot of options. And sometimes those include things like spinal cord stimulators, you're saying, which is an invasive procedure, but people do have that hope. And the other point you talked about was that the position. And I think we could again say how important it is to have a high quality position. And that high quality is defined as someone who is thorough and does that complete review. You talked about how the medical exam needs to correlate with any of the diagnostic testing, that MRI or CT scan they have, because those pieces together make up the right treatment plan, not one or the other, as you mentioned. But, you know, a lot of times people choose a position based on a lot of different things, but I think the outcome they get is not really what they expect. Really what we need to find are those doctors who are very skilled in their industry, the surgeons, I think you mentioned the orthopedic spine surgeons, some are fellowship trained, which gives them hopefully a little bit of added experience on those claims, but finding those doctors who have the good outcomes. And we think of work comp and the injured employee, but think of those professional athletes. You know, they're seeing those doctors and they want to get back in the game. And those doctors, I think, will probably have that reputation of getting those outcomes. And that's what we also want in the work comp industry. We want those quality and high functioning outcomes.
I totally agree. Additionally, I think a lot of people, I won't say everyone, is looking for that quick fix. Everyone wants the easy button, something that will get them out of pain quickly, easily, and return them back to their original condition as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, the body doesn't heal that way. Just like, and you mentioned professional athletes, when they have either a surgery or an injury, they don't just sit around, take medications, and wait for their body to heal. They are active in their recovery process. So they do a lot of physical therapy. It takes a lot of work. That becomes their job off the field until they are able to return back to the field.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Patty. So, Jeff, we like to end each episode with the final question. We want to connect to make a difference in injured employees' lives. Can you give an example of helping an injured employee or one of our partners?
Great question. Give me a moment. There is one claim that does stick out in my mind. There was an injured employee that was involved in a car accident and had chronic pain. His pain got so bad that when I was reviewing the claim, one of the doctor's notes mentioned he was concerned about the patient being suicidal. And then it was just kind of, I won't say brushed off, but he was referred to a psychiatrist. To me, that thought of self-harm was an extreme red flag. And we were able to get together with the insured, discuss that, and made sure that that employee was safe. So that would be the one that really hits home for me.
That's a great example of going an extra mile, because we really do want to be able to provide the best possible care for the employees that are injured at work. They're at their job doing what they need to be doing, and unfortunately, accidents do happen sometimes.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Patty. We at MEC Connect aim to make a positive difference in your lives, and we hope that listening to today's podcast has done that, and that you will stay tuned and continue to join us when we release new podcast episodes of MEC Connect. Thank you. Have a great day.